Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, I'm joined by former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson and NSA whistleblower Tom Drake about Dragnet surveillance.
Hello, NSA, I just called you to say I love you because you really listen.
Roy Zimmerman opens our podcast today.
Now when I'm on the phone, will I never feel alone, 'cause you're out there with your headphones and you really listen.
What you'll learn today is that in 2002, during the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics, the NSA tested out Dragnet surveillance on every form of electronic communication coming in and out of a geolocated area near Salt Lake City. It is a stunning set of revelations driving a new lawsuit by Rocky Anderson, who was also the Justice Party's candidate for president in 2012. I'm delighted to present this important interview for you, and it's made possible by people who subscribe to my podcast. People like Carla Mahoney, William Janetta, Grant Gibson, and Benny Alto. I'd like you to become a subscriber, too. Just drop into peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, and then follow the links to become a subscriber. That'll take you to the sign-up page. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, two stalwart defenders of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and in particular, the Fourth Amendment. Back in 2002, when the Winter Olympics were held in Salt Lake City, the National Security Agency installed a blanket, a dome, a dragnet over the entire region. And we're just learning the details about this now because of an important lawsuit that's being guided by Rocky Anderson, Salt Lake City's former mayor. He was the Justice Party's candidate for president in 2012, and he got my vote. And he is the lead attorney, I think, on this case. Rocky, great to talk to you again.
Great talking to you. And, Peter, actually, I'm the only attorney right now.
Okay.
I'd like to change that because the list of Department of Justice lawyers on this thing goes down an entire column on a page. So we are up against it. But we felt that with statute of limitations running and not able to get other organizations, other lawyers to take on the case, I actually reactivated my bar license, got back in to the practice, and instead of being a plaintiff, which I had hoped to be after reading a Wall Street Journal article disclosing that this had all happened, I decided we've got to do the legal work and get this case filed.
Well, I'm hoping that there is a constitutional attorney who is listening today and who might want to volunteer to join your legal team, Rocky. We'll see if that pans out. Also joining us today is Thomas Drake. Tom Drake was a senior executive at the NSA, and he was subjected to prosecution under the Espionage Act, and he took a plea deal that cost him his security clearance and his livelihood, and he has been an outspoken advocate for our constitutional rights. I've been talking to Tom for 4 or 5 years now. Tom, great to have you with us again.
I appreciate you returning me to your show.
Well, it's an honor to have you both here. Now, Rocky, give us the background because, you know, I had my own suspicions about what was going on during the Winter Olympics when Mitt Romney rode in to save the day. But of course, this was just a few months after 9/11, and we now know from Tom Drake and other whistleblowers of the NSA that the agency went into overdrive, was given presidential approval to collect it all, and it appears that Salt Lake City was a kind of model project to test out the capabilities, security may have been an actual concern. But it seems like this was an exercise by the NSA to flex its digital muscles.
Well, I was actually the host city mayor during the 2002 Winter Olympic Games.
Right, yeah.
Of course, I was very involved with Mitt Romney and others in the planning for the Olympic Games. We met several times with people who were planning in terms of security and all that. Like you said, it was just months after 9/11. And even before 9/11, though, I had fears that there would be mayhem because of different groups coming in to town, like we saw in Seattle, for instance, during the riots there, Montreal, number of cities around the world where people chose these international venues to destroy property, sometimes engage in violence, to make their point. So after 9/11, we were all extremely concerned, but we never had any inkling that our own federal government would be engaging in blatantly unconstitutional and otherwise illegal surveillance on our own people. Mm-hmm. And if they had, I've been asked, well, did you know about it? My response is always, no, I would have raised unholy hell if I had known that our own government was going to so disregard the rule of law and spy on our own residents and the visitors to Salt Lake City and all of the Olympic venues. So the first I ever heard of this was in an article. This story broke in the Wall Street Journal in August of 2013. And that was a story that I think had more than one source. Certainly coming from the Wall Street Journal, we figured there was a lot of credibility to these accounts. And I tried to get a number of organizations that deal with these kinds of issues to look into it and perhaps file a lawsuit. I offered to be a plaintiff, being the former mayor and the mayor at the time that this happened. And we couldn't get any takers, but because there were some courageous people who stood forward, and especially, I've got to say, Tom Drake, and I say that whether he's on the line or present or not, this is an unbelievably courageous man who has put it all on the line and has paid a tremendously heavy price for standing up for the truth and for the rule of law.
And he's made a dramatic declaration, which should certainly strengthen your hand when you bring this to trial. Now, Rocky, when you talk about the preparations, and you had some meetings with Romney, who was brought in to kind of rescue the games, what kind of security concerns were addressed? And was there any discussion of, intercepting cell phones, of monitoring email and text message as a preventive measure in terms of securing this international event?
Not one word. And everybody that was around at the time has said the same, that they didn't know that this kind of thing would be happening. Even Senator Bennett, who was in the United States Senate at the time, said he had no idea that this was going to go on. But then, unfortunately, he followed up with a statement that he would have been surprised if the NSA did not engage in that kind of surveillance. And that always perplexed me, that kind of an attitude, especially by somebody in the United States Congress, when Congress passed laws, including the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, making every instance of this kind of surveillance a federal felony, for him to say that the executive branch should just make up the rules as they go along, that he would have been surprised if they hadn't blatantly violated the Constitution and domestic laws passed by Congress. I find probably more shocking that the NSA would violate the law. I find more shocking than that the kind of complacency that we see from so many people about not only violations of our privacy rights, but such a total disregard for the rule of law.
Tom Drake, you were a senior executive at the NSA during the fall of 2001, leading into the Winter Olympics period of 2002. And some things had already, you know, made you aware of the changes that Mike Hayden was spearheading at the agency. And let me just stipulate that you and other whistleblowers from the NSA who I've talked to always had deep respect for the true mission of the NSA and were very aggressive in your work toward the end of monitoring people outside the United States. That's what the NSA is chartered to do. But you really were taken aback by the developments in the fall of 2001. So help our listeners understand at what point you became aware of the plan for dragnet surveillance of the Salt Lake City Olympics.
Well, it's important to note just briefly that I became aware within just a short time after 9/11 that the White House had authorized NSA to turn its extraordinary surveillance powers and point them within the United States of America, unleashing a program called Stellar Wind, and effectively turning the United States of America into the equivalent of a foreign nation for the purpose of blanket electronic surveillance, beginning with phone numbers, and then rapidly accelerating from there to include a lot of other data, email addresses, internet usage, financial information. In fact, Stellar Wind is an umbrella program under which a number of other programs existed and were formed later. And so that was the foundation. Because of the 9/11 failures, the excuse was we just need the data. And it doesn't matter where it is. And that under the power of the president, and this was argued in some memos and later disclosures, in secret, actually, interestingly enough, the justification that the president had inherent executive authority to do this. Under his Article II Commander-in-Chief powers. And so that was the foundation. I began to hear murmurs about this field op that was going to be used as sort of the first instantiation of Stellar Wind on an even larger scale, meaning that what I've called a golden opportunity to put everything that was available and essentially put a surveillance shield bubble, as it were, over the Salt Lake City venues. And obviously hiding behind the fact, international event on U.S. soil, a lot of international media, political figures, celebrities, and of course, you know, press as well as athletes. And so it was sort of the perfect cover, is one way to put it. And it was, that was in the late December and then moving into early January timeframe as this began to ramp up. And that was the basis for NSA working with others, including the FBI, to provide the, what I've called the hidden surveillance, essentially monitoring a tremendous amount of electronic traffic coming into and out of the Salt Lake City venues related to the Winter Olympics.
Tom, can you tell us if the suite of surveillance products that were created by Harris Corporation, and I believe there are a couple of other companies that make systems that are commonly known as Stingray, these simulate a cell phone tower, require all phones to check in, dump their data, and it enables them to track the geolocation of each of the phones within range of the fake cell phone tower.
I don't know. I mean, Stingrays were quite, that was in, there were Stingrays available or the equivalent then, but that was really something newer. I can't speak directly to what the FBI actually employed in terms of that technology. I can only share with you in terms of NSA. it was sort of the perfect storm without hearing it to employ all kinds of surveillance. But also, people need to understand that there was a number of partnerships NSA had in secret. They could not have done this all by themselves with just the technology available to them. Much of this was done with incredibly sensitive agreements and arrangements with certain telcos and providers.
Mm-hmm.
And so both regional as well as national. And some of this was leveraging relationships that had existed for a long time, even relationships that had pre-existed 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Tom Drake, you have issued a declaration, a sworn statement, that is now part of the lawsuit that Rocky Anderson is carrying. And I want to read a couple of quotes. Item 5, Stellar Wind was an umbrella project of blanket indiscriminate surveillance on U.S. persons and people within the United States. The program involved far more than the surveillance and collection of foreign electronic communications. It also included the collection of domestic electronic communications traffic, including the contents of text messages and emails, and the metadata of telephone calls without any privacy protections or judicial oversight. So this is the so-called warrantless surveillance. I always find that euphemism offensive. It's unconstitutional if it's warrantless, and I don't think that's a point that can be argued. You later say that the Salt Lake Olympics field op included geofencing to set up virtual boundaries around Salt Lake City and nearby Olympic venues for a period of time before and during the Salt Lake City Winter Olympic Games. Virtually all electronic communication signals that went into or out of one of those designated areas were captured and stored by the NSA, including the contents of emails and text messages. The NSA stored the metadata for all those electronic signals. So what you're describing here is a massive system that treats everyone within range of this dragnet as a suspect, and it violates the probable cause and the requirement for a court order that is very clearly stated in the Fourth Amendment. Tom?
It didn't matter. It's important to note, it didn't matter. I mean, 9/11 changed the game. This was what I've called the reverse false flag. It was the excuse that was provided the highest levels of the government, up to and including the White House. In fact, the president signed an authorizing order on 4 October. I did not know it was 4 October. I became aware that the White House had approved what became known as the President Surveillance Program, but at NSA was known as the Stellar Wind Program, Stellar Wind at the time actually was classified. The actual name was classified. It was a highly compartmented ECI level plus program. Extraordinarily sensitive because it was the president authorizing it in the deepest of state secrecy, and it didn't matter. Who cares about the Fourth Amendment? Who cared about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was passed in 1978, been updated 5 times to keep up with the times prior to 9/11? It didn't matter. As someone told me shortly after all this. As I was confronting people, as I blew the whistle within internal channels over a number of years before I ultimately went to the press with unclassified information, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And so it didn't matter. Now, of course, the government knew at the highest levels that they were violating the Constitution, but hey, they're defending the nation. So, the stakes were considered far higher, and we were willing to sacrifice the Fourth Amendment and the fundamental rights of U.S. persons, which pretty much is everybody in the United States, to the altar of national security. And this was the field op that was really the first domestic instantiation in which they were able. They've been sweeping up a tremendous amount of data across the country secretly. This was the perfect opportunity to work it out and fine tune it, and practice, as it were. And hey, if you've done nothing wrong, you have nothing to worry about, right? The victim, it's victimless, right? And, hey, no one's going to know about it because it's all covered under the blanket of national security. I was eyewitness. This is the subversion of the Constitution by our own government. I found myself staring deeply into Pandora's box, watching all this happen. The abyss is staring back at me, and I found myself, and it's still is surreal when I say it this way, as I'll say it now on your program, found myself defending the Constitution, which I had now taken an oath at this point four times, support and defend, defending it against my own government. This is an extraordinary, extraordinary place to be. This is so many years ago now. And yet, you know, this was just one of a number of ops, but this was a critical one because this was, it was easy to hide behind security in terms of an international event hosted on U.S. soil.
Rocky Anderson, as the mayor at the time in Salt Lake City, you're a victim of this invasive dragnet surveillance that clearly violates the Constitution. I can only imagine how outraged you feel.
Well, I have been outraged, but also shocked at the incredible attitude on so many people's parts that it doesn't really matter, or we'll just look the other way because this was a few months after 9/11, and so what if it was the executive branch rather than Congress who decided which rules they were going to comply with, including the Constitution? It's at times like this that we have to be most vigilant. And instead, the people of this country, I think, repeating history in a lot of ways, seem to be so complacent about this. And I know there are plenty of people who just feel like there's nothing to be done. But I'll tell you, if people will stand up and let it be known that they won't stand for this anymore, that the Constitution and the rule of law are so utterly, fundamentally important to who we are as a people and what we are as a country, then we can reverse this. But you look at the size of the NSA. I'd recommend to anybody read, for instance, Top Secret America by Dana Priest. Mm-hmm. And the great investigative work that Arkin did for that book, she reported that even then, and without regard to what happened during the Olympics, 1.8 billion pieces of data provided to the NSA and stored by the NSA, processed by the NSA every single day, emails, use of internet, telephone calls, that's domestically. That's what we as people in this country, the way that we're communicating, and it entails, by the way, all privileged communications. They don't segregate out emails between lawyers and their clients or doctors and their patients or psychiatrists or priests and members of their congregation.
Mm-hmm.
This entails all communications, and as one court recently found when it determined that the NSA was gathering metadata on virtually every telephone call in this country, the excuse of the NSA in storing all of this was not that they had any particularized cause to gather that information, any of it, but that there might be some hypothetical crime in the future, and storing all of that data would allow the government then to go back and see who communicated with whom. Now, that is absolutely stunningly frightening, to live in a country that where we have the capacity now to store this kind of data and keep it forever so that whoever gets into office, And imagine the uses to which somebody like President Trump, with his disrespect for civil and human rights, that he could use this data, that you could go back and track whatever anybody communicated and with whom, and then who they were communicating with.
And Rocky, let me underscore that, because just in the last 24 hours, my friend and colleague Jason Leopold has secured a copy of an Intelligence Community Inspector General's report. And it shows, for example, just one case that has been cited, a female employee at the DNI, Director of National Intelligence Facility, violated the Privacy Act over 650 times, 600 and some. There were 367 queries about Edward Snowden in a two-week period. And she was not authorized or, you know, on cases that, you know, gave her the authority to probe these very sensitive databases. And this is an example of the widespread access to information that we're told is very carefully held, very carefully controlled. And, you know, that they, you know, the FBI has said that they've disciplined people who looked at databases that they shouldn't have. But this is a screaming example of the potential for abuse. And this woman, whose name is redacted, had 14 part-time jobs where she was a security consultant to different corporate entities. And she was able to provide information to her clients by accessing these, again, what are supposed to be highly secure data collection systems. So, Tom, let me turn to you first. How outrageous is this finding by the Inspector General, or how average is it, actually, in your experience?
I would say it's average, because the ability to abuse is extraordinarily prevalent. In spite of all that you hear publicly about insider threat and locking down the systems and making it more secure, how do you verify this? If you're an oversight person, how do you verify it? You have to rely on the very agency that you're overseeing, absent, you know, technical capability and expertise, that they're actually telling you the truth. And that's ripe for abuse in itself. It was one of the phrases that I heard early on was, we will tell them what we want them to hear. Which means it doesn't matter whether we tell them the truth or not. We'll tell them what we want them to hear.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you both, to what extent do you believe that key elected officials are compromised by information that has been collected on them by the FBI or the NSA? Russell Tice, who was one of your associates at the NSA, Tom, has told me that he saw the orders to wiretap Dianne Feinstein when she was a ranking member of the Intelligence Committee. She later became chair. He saw wiretap orders for members of the Supreme Court for Barack Obama after he surfaced as a United States senator. And knowing what we knew about J. Edgar Hoover and his collection on 3x5 file cards of the dirt of political leaders, we have to suspect that there is a more advanced digital database that provides the same function. Let me turn to you first, Tom, for comment.
Well, the example I cite is extremely current. It's Comey actually in some way confronting Donald Trump himself. No matter what else you think of President Trump, you know, the history of the FBI is not clean.
Mm-hmm.
You could have said that meeting, in many respects, was very Hoover-like, meaning the threat, obviously, is that we know things that we're not going to tell you, but it was, the implication was that we may have dirt on you without actually saying it. Most people have skipped right over that because they're essentially giving Comey a pass. Comey is not innocent here. It's important to note that. There's a lot of identity politics going on. It's somehow Comey and the national security state are going to save the Constitution. It's been my experience, if that's the case, that's similar to save the village, we have to destroy it. Why would you want to rip out the heart of the governance, the foundational governance principles and law, which is the highest, you know, the law of the land is the Constitution. That's the highest law on the basis that national security takes primacy and priority. But that's effectively what has happened. And I don't actually say these words lightly, given my own experience. My own example, of course, is a stark reminder to people. It's exhibit number one, that if you call out the government for wrongdoing, in this case, and I've said this, high crimes and misdemeanors being committed by up to and including the President of the United States, yeah, they're not going to take it too lightly. They're probably going to come after you with everything they've got, especially when they were using national security to hide all this. So the digital age is posing an extraordinary challenge for society, because those in secret have secret power, and that secret power can be significantly abused, especially the kind of power we're talking about. And the temptations are enormous to use it as when you want to, or as a threat to blackmail people or to hold it over their head. There's many, many stark historical examples, including Martin Luther King Jr.
Right. And Tom, that
was way before the digital age.
Right. I take your point, and I agree that Comey described how the other people who were expecting to leave government designated him as the one to brief Trump on the dossier from the British MI6 guy. That included the salacious claims about water sports at the Ritz in Moscow. But I would extend it to Bob Mueller as well, because he took over the day before 9/11 as head of the FBI, and he proceeded to abuse the Constitution using the authorities of the Patriot Act, silencing whistleblowers in his own agency, like my friend Sabelle Edmonds. And to see him brought in as the guy who is going to investigate all this really just extends the power of the so-called deep state. And he's a made man of the deep state, and somebody who can be relied upon to protect the interests and the secrets, and to protect his own history legacy at the FBI. And so I do understand the perspective that you offer there. And I recognize, too, that the corporate media has just gone, hook, line and sinker for the Russia hacked, Russia manipulated the election memes, which are still unproven assertions based on, no public evidence and a series of leaks from anonymous individuals past and present in the security division of our government. So I think what you're saying is something our listeners should pay close attention to.
Peter,
it is ironic, and I've said it's highly hypocritical, the recent case of Reality Winner, where it's clear that, and there's no indication that the document that was released, that's allegedly, I have to say allegedly released by Reality Winner and allegedly to The Intercept, there's no indication at all that that is a false document. Some people have suggested in the past certain things have been released may not be fake. We remember the famous which was a fake intelligence report about yellow cake in Niger, and
that
the case with Valerie Plame being outed as punishment with Ambassador Joe Wilson, who actually went on an assignment to make that determination, and then they tried to silence him, and he wrote an op-ed about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no indication that the document, the NSA document, and what I find is this extraordinary hypocrisy. That taking the document at face value, that there was some interference, right, related to a part of the electoral system, in this case, one of the companies that makes equipment, ostensibly by Russia or those operating on behalf of Russia or the equivalent or proxies, and then to have the full weight of the government come down on her, when people were screaming and screaming, right, for the evidence, and then when this kind of evidence, now that you're dismissing, well, we already knew that, we don't have to worry about it. This was an actual document, right? But guess who pays the price? the person who actually disclosed the document.
Well, Tom, I do think the document is authentic. I don't think that it proves very much. And
no, I agree.
I feel reality winner.
Hypocrisy.
Yeah. Okay. I know Rocky wants to get in here. Go ahead, Mr. Anderson.
I just want to impress upon those who become so cynical or so resigned in the face of what's happening, look back at the 1970s. When we had statesmen and stateswomen in our Congress, and even in the administration, who took seriously the violations of our Constitution, the violations of our own way of life, by our own intelligence community. Tom made reference a minute ago to Martin Luther King Jr. The FBI illegally wiretapped his conversations and then tried to use them against him in blackmailing him into committing suicide. That was finally all disclosed, all the instances of the CIA opening people's mail, all the wiretapping that was done without warrants. Congress cared at the time. They assigned committees. In the Senate, it was called the Church Committee, after Frank Church, the senator from Idaho. And they exposed all of this. They held investigations. As said, that light is the best disinfectant. Well, they applied a lot of light to what went on in our intelligence community. And they said, okay, now that we know this is what's been happening, we're going to take steps as the United States Congress to make sure that the executive branch never engages in these kinds of abuses of American civil liberties again. And they passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that made every instance of warrantless surveillance a federal felony. And then it was George Bush who said, oh, that doesn't matter. I'm the commander-in-chief. I can disregard these laws passed by Congress. So we've come sort of full circle, but without a Congress that seems to care about our Constitution, about these violations. And instead, what did they do? They rubber stamped so many of these violations by the amendment to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that President Obama, when he was in the United States Senate, voted for, and that also included retroactive immunity for the telecom companies that illegally worked with the Bush administration in helping spy on the American people. So we've reached a point where instead of taking the care to protect the rights of the people of this country against our own government, and I think that we're a lot more risked during the Cold War than we are now as a nation, and in terms of our personal security, but Congress in the late 70s said, no, that was no excuse. But now everybody turns the other way, and all they can talk about is the fear and the terror and the responses that we've got to make to all of that. And then what do they do to a truth teller like Tom Drake, who works within channels? Tom is one of he's as straight a person as I've ever known. He didn't go out like Ed Snowden and go to the media and send them all this material that was supposed to be protected. He worked through channels, and the price that he paid was unbelievable because our federal government charged him with espionage. There are more espionage prosecutions during the Obama administration than ever before in our nation's history. And these charges were applied against people who were simply trying to get the truth out to the American people. And then they ended up dropping the charges, I don't know, Tom, what was it, a week before trial, and reducing the charge to one count of unauthorized use of a computer, putting Tom and his family through this utter hell, depriving him of his classified status, of his job, of his ability to do what he was so brilliant at doing, because he went through channels and he tried to get the truth out to Congress and the American people. And Ed Snowden has said that there would be no Ed Snowden if there were no Thomas Drake.
Well, and Tom, expand on that, because you, in a recent interview with Dennis Bernstein, made a remark quite similar, that it was you getting burned after trying to go through channels and trying to work through the available remedies for someone in your position. And I want to underscore, you never disclosed any classified information, but you went to the intelligence committees, you went to inspector generals, I believe, and you got burned. And that's the reason that Snowden said, I'm not going to repeat that mistake.
No, he has said that a number of times because he saw what happened to me and the others. And what's happened is any indication that someone has gone to the press in the public interest is regarded by the government as espionage by default. It's assumed that way, and that launches a criminal investigation. In my own case, the truth is actually even starker, because I knew from early on that our governance mechanism had come off the rails in secret. And this would have enormous downstream consequences strategically. That in the tumult and in the fear of the 9/11 failure, 3,000 intelligence failure, which it really was, not 9/11 resulted in almost 3,000 people being murdered. And so the government's off the rails. And I remember even early on, just a few short weeks after 9/11. Confronting the lead attorney, NSA, saying, what are we doing violating FISA and the Fourth Amendment? And if it's not working, if FISA, which was the exclusive means by which you could conduct the type of warranted surveillance on a U.S. person suspected of being up to no good and endangering national security, you had a secret court mechanism that you went through. And he said, you don't understand. I said, wait a minute. There's a constitutional means by which you change the law or update the law. So why don't you go to Congress? And what he told me was chilling. He said, with what we want to do, they'll say no. So it didn't matter what the Constitution required. It didn't matter what the law said. And to make it worse, years later, when all of this started coming out, which eventually it did, primarily with a Rise and Lichtblau article in the New York Times in December of 2005, held for over 14 months at the request of the White House, because they said it was such a tippy-top state secret that we couldn't reveal it. We needed it for counterterrorism. It all started coming out. So then, guess what? Well, let's have Congress pass laws to make legal what was patently unlawful and unconstitutional. Ex post facto laws are actually a violation of the Constitution. You can't make a law to make legal what was unconstitutional in the first place. But that's what we did.
And Tom, I need to ask you, and I want to be cautious here, but your declaration is based on information that you gleaned while you were at the NSA. Do you fear that they will try to prosecute you in this instance?
No, because I've talked extensively about Stellar Wind. This is just an instantiation of it. I'm not worried about that at all.
Okay, good. Let me turn to something that you mentioned a while ago, Tom, and that is that in the organizing stage of this field operation at the 2002 Olympics in Salt Lake, the telecom companies, both national and regional, were involved. And I've always had unanswered questions about Qwest. They're a regional carrier based in Denver. I happen to own 20 or 25 shares in the company, so I get the annual reports. And their CEO, Joe Nocchio, went to prison for alleged insider trading. And I always suspected that he was being punished because after this episode in Salt Lake City, my understanding is that Qwest refused to collaborate further with the NSA, where the other national carriers caved in and actually profited by selling our data to the NSA in many instances.
Yeah, Rocky may actually have something to say about that. I'm actually well aware of the Nocchio case. It's one of the few cases. There have been several, some of them have still not been made public, where telcos, telecoms, and other providers actually push back saying, hey, where's the warrant?
Right.
Where's instead of just going along with it, saying, hey, what's good for American national security is good for us. This is a case where there was actually pushback, and of course, NSA found a way to punish. They didn't take too kindly to those who did not want to cooperate in the interest of national security. But Rocky, I'll let you have a chance on this because I know you have some information about it.
Go ahead, Rocky.
Yeah, well, Joe Nocio was asked to go back to Fort Meade to meet with people in the NSA. He was flown back. He went into a room. Everything was on a need-to-know basis. People wouldn't even introduce themselves by name. And they asked him, they talked to him at the time about their need for this kind of surveillance, and they assumed that he would go along with them.
Rocky, let me just interject one point that I'm aware of. The request was for domestic and local calling records. It didn't have any international component. Am I correct?
Exactly. It was here in Salt Lake City at Quest Communications. And they were going to put their equipment on Quest's, connect it to Quest's equipment, and gather this data on every telephone call that came through their system.
Mm-hmm.
And his response was, "Where's your warrant?" And they were extremely upset with him. His general counsel advised that they not do it without a warrant, that it would be illegal under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the Constitution. But after he got out of prison, and this is frankly the thing that pushed me finally to file this lawsuit, was, and this is about coming up on 2 years after the Wall Street Journal article that disclosed that this had happened, he held a press conference at the press club in Washington, D.C. after he was released from federal penitentiary. I believe he was there for 6 years on charges of insider trading. And he said at that time that he thinks that this kind of surveillance did take place during the Olympics, that they could have used Quest equipment, and that too would have been done on a need-to-know basis, and he would not have been informed about that happening. But, you know, all the evidence, except for these declarations that have been submitted now by the current operations director and by Michael Hayden, who at the time was the director of the NSA, all the rest of the evidence points clearly to the fact that there was this indiscriminate blanket surveillance of communications, including the content of text messages and emails of every person whose communications were handled outside of the Salt Lake City area. I mean, like this telephone call, even if you were in Salt Lake City, it would run through a route that goes outside Salt Lake City. So I think that the NSA, first of all, in this case, it's one of less than a handful of cases that have survived motion to dismiss. The government is fighting us tooth and nail, but we beat them on their motion to dismiss, where they claimed that our clients didn't have standing, and now they filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings. The individual defendants, which include George Bush, Dick Cheney, Michael Hayden, and Dick Cheney's legal counsel and chief of staff, David Addington, they're sort of sitting on the sidelines to see what happens with our claims against the NSA, but they've also filed, the individual defendants filed a motion for summary judgment. And I think with Tom's help and with some of the other evidence that's going to be coming out, I think that there is no way that they're going to be able to escape accountability for what they did in Salt Lake City, and they need to come clean to us.
I hope you're right, Rocky.
Representative of our government.
They'll use anything. They'll, you know, come up with some claim of state secrets privilege, or you got to expect that everything they've got in their arsenal will be used.
Well,
and I want to affirm what you described about Nocio and the demand from the government, because we know that AT&T rolled over. Mark Klein, the technician who blew the whistle here in San Francisco, observed the installation of a huge fiber optic splitter in a secret room at an AT&T facility in San Francisco. And because he didn't have a security clearance and was essentially not vulnerable, he was able to self-publish a book about it, and he's been very open about what he was able to glean just from watching equipment arrive and this special room being installed. So that part certainly pans out. Tom, I want to turn to you for a moment because in your declaration, you preemptively respond to the denials of Mike Hayden and other NSA officials. And you say that you know that statements made by Hayden in his declaration are false or, if not literally false, substantially misleading. And he's a pretty slippery guy. He's been public promoting a book over the last few months, and he's got that riff about privacy versus security and the difficult balance that we have to strike. But he's a really evil figure in my book, and I think that you have to expect that he's willing to lie more in an effort to undermine your credibility.
Yes, but it's extraordinarily ironic, given what you just said, because Hayden himself has repeatedly said for a number of years now. I remember in a CPAC conference last year, he was in the debate. Lou Dobbs, the moderator, with Judge Napolitano, and was asked what was the legal basis. This is before all of the ex post facto. Passage of certain acts, starting with the Protect America Act, which got folded into the FISA Amendments Act, which also gave the telecoms retroactive immunity, the update to the Patriot Act, the subsequent reauthorization of the FISA Amendments Act without any changes or amendments whatsoever. He said, when asked what was the basis, the legal basis, he said raw executive authority, raw executive authority. When I'm in front of college students of various kinds, depending on whether journalism students or government or policy, public administration, or a mix, I say, what form of government is it that uses raw executive authority to govern? Well, it's certainly not a constitutional republic or a democracy of any stripe. But so he's admitting that the basis for what took place before laws were passed to make it legal, he's admitting that it was simply the unitary executive theory, all right, of Article II powers under the commander-in-chief, powers of the president. And that's the basis for why they did this in the end.
So, well, Tom, I would just insert that the failure of the courts and the Congress to play their appropriate roles in attempting to check or balance the executive branch is at the heart of this failure.
Yes, it is. But ultimately, some would say, what's the fatal flaw in the Constitutional Republic or our special form of democracy? It's we the people in order to form a perfect union. Those are the precise words that open up the preamble of the Constitution before you have all the enumerated powers across the multiple articles. It's we the people. We have to care about this. You're right. It does not let off those who are in positions of power, who elected and unelected. It does not let them off the hook. And that's why shows like yourself, as well as other press and media, are incredibly critical and crucial to informing the public. That's the public interest part of this. How do you know what's going on? How do you know what's going on to make sure that those who represent us and those who don't but are in government are actually doing so in the public interest? Now, I've had people say, Tom, you're so naive. Just get used to it. The human condition. Well, if that was the case, we wouldn't have gotten very far. I realize that arc, that long, the moral arc of the universe, or say the long arc of history, doesn't bend uniformly toward justice. It doesn't uniformly bend toward liberty or freedom. But if you're not standing on top of it, jumping up and down, or if they try to do me, hang me on it, well, then it's not going to bend, is it?
Well, and Tom, I say don't accept it. Don't get used to it, because this is my contract with my government, and they are unilaterally breaking that contract, and they do not have any authority to do so, and we must keep pressing our rights until we find the proper approach to overcome them. And, Rocky, this is where your lawsuit, I think, has important potential.
Well, I think it really is important for people to be aware of what's happened in the past and the remedial things that need to be done to make sure that we never face this again. Just as Congress in 1978-79 period after the Church Committee and the passage of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act thought they were going to prevent against this kind of warrantless surveillance on the people of this country. But when we're talking about the need to know and the contract we have with one another, I've got to point out the New York Times knew about the president's surveillance program, absolutely violative of both the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the Fourth Amendment. They knew about it for over a year and a half.
Yeah.
And during that year and a half period when they weren't disclosing it, President George W. Bush was reelected. That information should have been disclosed to the American people so we could make a decision in that reelection campaign about a president who claimed that he had the absolute power under the supposed uniform executive branch and as commander-in-chief to decide when and under what circumstances he was going to follow the laws passed by Congress and our nation's Constitution.
Yeah.
You know, we forget in terms of history. I mean, I grew up as a very young teenager in the 70s. You know, I'm well aware of the famous, you know, the Nixon legal doctrine, I'll say it that way, axiom, which is the president says, okay, it's not illegal. People forget that one of the articles of impeachment against Richard Milhouse Nixon was actually abusing instruments of national power. That included the FBI, CIA, military elements, and NSA. This was the president of the United States in the fall of 2001, early fall of 2001, right after 9/11. He's saying, you know what? I'm going to sign an order that authorizes the NSA to violate en masse the Fourth Amendment, regardless of the fact that there was a statute with criminal sanctions for every instance of violation. That's a single person, every instance of the violation, up to a $10,000 fine, 5 years in prison. Who has been held accountable for that since? In this case, only the person who blew the whistle on it, which was me.
Yep.
And that should tell you something. That should tell you what has happened in our country. And so if rule of law matters, if rights matter, if keeping irresponsible power in check matters, then this is what we have to stand up against. Otherwise, for all the faults and foibles and flaws of the United States and our governance system, and there are many, what that grand experiment that was launched, you know, in 1789, right? That grand experiment, 1787, ratified, you know, 2 years later in 1789. Which then took another 2 years before we actually had a Bill of Rights, by the way. But that grand experiment that was launched at the very dawn of this country after a violent American Revolution against a king who didn't care about the rights of those, you know, colonists on the other side of the ocean. Well, I don't know what else matters, right? And it's not just the United States. It's this emerging, a very disturbing trend of moving increasingly toward, you know, autocratic and authoritarian government, the need for others to be in control. And ultimately, this is about social control. It really is. It has far less to do with counterterrorism, has far less to do with national security. There is a very small number of people and companies making extraordinary amounts of money off of this, the fear-mongering, the hyperinflating, the new Cold War 2.0, that people want to go back to some bygone era because it's a lot simpler to declare Russia the enemy. You know, terrorism stuff gets kind of confusing and nuanced, and it's like you can't find them very well. hey, let's bring back the big red menace. That makes the world a lot simpler to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so we face some real challenges, and history is not kind. There is nothing in history that somehow gives us a get out of history free card. It just doesn't.
Well, Tom, I share your passion. This really does matter. It still matters. It matters actually more than ever because our political leaders have felt that the American people have accepted this as the new normal. And, they even have TV shows. There's this strange show on CBS this year where they pay people to become fugitives so that they can track them down. And it exposes all of the surveillance cameras that are out there and the different techniques that the government has to keep track of people. And so, yes, the American public has been sufficiently pacified. And I'm really glad that Rocky is bringing this case. I was surprised that the Washington Post actually covered it in a June 2nd article. And Rocky, as we wrap up, I invite you to stay in touch with me on any developments of the case, and I'll share them with listeners. Do you have a blog or anything related to this case where people could access updates and read some of the declarations?
Yes, we're posting a lot of the material and a lot of the articles on rockyanderson.org. And I also want to say to your listeners and to anyone who seeks to know more about this and who may be looking for inspiration, because this is absolutely inspirational reading. Mark Hertzgard's excellent book, Bravehearts, and Tom Drake is the principal person that he writes about, but a lot of people, including, of course, Edward Snowden and the lessons Edward Snowden learned from Thomas Drake, and then also a fantastic book, The War on Leakers. And that's by Lloyd Gardner. It's a fantastic book about how our government is not trying to enforce the laws against this illegal surveillance. Rather, they're turning their aim on those like Thomas Drake who are standing up in the most principled way to return our nation to a constitutional republic and take us away from that trail toward authoritarianism.
And my listeners can find an interview with Mark Hertzgard on my website. Just put his name with two A's in the search window, and it'll pop right up. Rocky Anderson, thanks for taking this case. We'll stay in touch with you. Tom Drake, as always, you have my deep respect, and I really appreciate that you have not stopped fighting for our constitutional rights.
I've dedicated the rest of my life to defending life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, so because it matters.
So thank you for helping get the word out, Peter.
Tom Drake, Rocky Anderson, on the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview. Your comments and feedback are always welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Smiling up.